Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Religion Prof Podcast. I'm delighted to have as my guest on the show today, Sarah Parks, who is Assistant Professor in New Testament Studies at the University of Nottingham. And she is the author of a very recent book, which is simply fascinating and is the main reason that I wanted to get her on the podcast and chat with her. But as with so many of my guests, we have multiple intersecting interests, and so I will not even try to predict where the conversation might go. But her recent book is Gender in the Rhetoric of Jesus, Women in Q, which has been published by Lexington Books and Fortress Academic Press. So Sarah, welcome, and thank you for being on the podcast today.
Hi, James. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start by asking a question of, you know, how did you end up working on this particular topic? Like, what's the process that led to this book being written?
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, in general, I'm interested in women in like Second Temple Judaism and early Christianity. And so at some point I was looking into attitudes toward women in the Gospels. And then, you know, you're faced with the Gospels, you're faced with kind of ambiguity and divergent treatments of women. And then you've got so many layers. And so I'm always wondering, okay, does this tradition get introduced by this author? Are there women here that were really important who are getting downplayed or erased? Is the treatment of this female character like earlier or later in the tradition? Or what goes all the way back to Jesus? Does this go all the way back to Jesus? And so depending where you draw the line, you get different answers. And all of a sudden, I thought, what if I were to separate out Jesus' sayings material, particularly the sayings that people sort of more or less agree to be authentic? So like the shared sayings across Luke and Matthew, which people call Q, what kind of Jesus would we get? And would there be any clues there to his attitude toward women? And I actually thought, no, there probably won't. But I had a sit with the reconstructed text of Q, and it was decidedly a different flavor. And I did find that, in my opinion, there is a lot to work with in terms of women. And some other people have looked into like the Sophia language in these early sayings, such as Melanie Johnson DeBoffrey. But I decided I wanted to look deeper into that, the gender pairs, the practice of pairing two parables according to gender, which is found in Q.
Yeah, and this is such a typically academic experience where you go into something thinking there's probably nothing there, and as you start looking at it, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much there.
Exactly.
So give an example of, you know, when you talk about gender pairs in parables and sayings material, what kinds of things are we talking about?
Okay, so if anyone who's familiar with the New Testament, you've heard these, but you might not think of them as pairs, but they're things like the parable of the lost coin and the parable of the lost sheep, or the parable of the mustard seed and the yeast, or there's a parable of the queen of the south and the Ninevite men. Those are all basically repeat lessons. Like the parables tell the same story twice, but they use like a male protagonist, such as Ninevite men, and the second time they use a female protagonist, such as the queen of the south. And some of them, I mean, there's no men and women in them at all. So you're like, oh, what's this got to do with gender? But if you're looking at, say, the ravens and the lilies, the gendered part is actually some kind of career or task. So the lilies don't, you know, spin wool and sew garments, and yet they're beautiful. And the ravens don't plant seeds and then harvest and store stuff in barns, but yet they get fed. Well, spinning wool is a woman's task in first century Galilee, and harvesting is a man's task typically. So there are all kinds of these in Q.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm asking questions. I mean, having read your book, you know, I know that people asking these questions, it could sound like I'm not reading this book, but I'm so excited by some of the things that you highlight in the book that I want to give you a chance to sort of share them on the podcast and make sure others are hopefully lured into reading your book as well. So in those gender pairs, there's, on the one hand, you detect a distinctive aspect of Jesus' teaching that sort of seems to set him apart from what was typical in, you know, among ancient teachers. And yet there is, as your examples you just cited highlight, this assumption of disparate tasks for men and women in the society. So say a little bit more about what you found. Like, what is Jesus teaching on this, and how does it look when it starts to come into focus in the way that it did for you in your study?
Okay, well, that's a great question, because once I discovered that Q had a lot of these, I went and looked at there's a limited amount of scholarship of people who have talked about these gender pairs in Q. And what I found was that the scholarship was totally divided in two opposite directions. And half of the scholars were saying, you know, this is total egalitarianism. This is gender egalitarianism at the heart of the Jesus movement. This is feminist. This is equality. And the other half of the scholars were saying that this is a totally still an androcentric text in the language it uses, like calling the people sons or brothers. The gendered tasks are still completely fixed into normal gendered roles, like women do this and men do that. Like, it's not the woman shepherd who loses her sheep and the man sweeping the floor who loses the coin. It's the male shepherd and the woman sweeping the floor, like, as normal. And so there was this real divide about what these pairs meant. And so that's what I kind of tackled in the book, saying, yes, it's complicated. It's both and. But there definitely is something going on here where, in my opinion, these pairs at least show that Jesus was surrounded by women and really bothered to tailor material to them.
Yeah, and historians seem to constantly struggle to do justice to the both and. We have a tendency to want the past, whether it's Jesus or any other figure that people look back to have them speak to our time in a way that not just can be shown to be relevant in some way, but seems contemporary and direct, thoroughly patriarchal or thoroughly egalitarian does. So what are some of the challenges, and what are some of the complexities of trying to do justice to the sort of both and scenario that you found in some of the source material?
Well, I really wanted to honor the scholarship of those who had gone before and said, look, for all these reasons, this is a patriarchal society, and this is still an androcentric text, and Jesus is not some kind of proto 21st century feminist. And those caveats were right, but at the same time, I wanted to honor those who were saying, there is something here that's innovative, and Jesus doesn't have to be like the first person who was ever looking towards women and saying, these are in some way my intellectual equal. He doesn't have to be the first and only person in antiquity to do that in order for there to be something there that, on the spectrum from totally misogynist to 21st century intersectional feminist, is moving somewhere toward the latter.
Yeah, I think the 22nd century feminists are probably actually going to do even better than we're doing. But
one hopes.
Yeah, remains to be seen, of course.
Yeah.
actually, having said that, I'm sure that it's going to be proven that I'm not among the prophets at some point. Although, probably nobody's going to be blaming me for getting it wrong. So
no.
I hope I'm right. Anyway, and the 23rd, even better. But of course, for Star Trek fans, that's a clearer picture that we already have.
I was wondering how long it was going to take for you to work Star Trek in.
Well, I wanted to, because I thought, for the benefit of those people listening who include people who are interested in New Testament early Christianity and put up with my sci-fi interests, but also people who share my sci-fi interests and put up with my interest in New Testament and early Christianity.
Something
I did want to,
everybody.
Yeah, something for everybody, or you know, something to annoy everybody. It was probably more like it. But wanted to clarify for one of those two groups that the Q that you've been referring to is not the character on Star Trek. At least I don't think it is, but is a source that scholars think lies behind Matthew and Luke and is reflected in the material they share that they didn't derive from Mark. And I do want to say that despite the impression one can get certainly online, where I think the proportion of representation differs, but among academics working in the field, I do think that the Q hypothesis, right, the idea that Matthew and Luke wrote independently of each other using Mark as well as this common saying source separately, is still the predominant view among scholars, although there are some really fascinating challenges to it. But with Q skepticism, if one can call it that, getting at least renewed attention and interesting discussions about the synoptic problem and variations on views and things like that, for the Q skeptics out there, for the people who, as soon as you say, well, this is what I see happening in Q, and they don't accept the Q hypothesis, and therefore maybe they therefore don't get, they don't read your book and don't take the, what's the message of what you found for somebody who thinks there is no Q? I mean, is there still some relevance for them of the things that you discovered in the sources?
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm glad you asked that. Well, yes, absolutely, because you're studying Jesus' sayings. I have actually have a quote from the book about this. It's near the back. Yes, I said, this project remains significant whether one goes so far as to stratify Q in the footsteps of Kloppenburg or doubts Q's very existence in the footsteps of Goodacre. Even if one is not convinced by the two-source hypothesis, the gendered pairs form part of what Jesus scholars deem to be authentic material that dates back to his Galilean career. With or without Q, the parallel parable pairs are sayings that text critics, redaction critics, and historical Jesus scholars connect with Jesus. Their importance as deliberately gender-aware and in their way gender-leveling evidence remains. So I did try to, I mean, I hope it's clear throughout the book that it doesn't really matter if one buys into the Q hypothesis. It's still important to look at these sayings. Q is one of those points in New Testament scholarship where skepticism is really hip right now. And a lot of people rush to ask me like, oh, what if there's no Q? Your book is useless. But honestly, I'm not sure of a single area of New Testament research that isn't based on hypotheses that we have to work with. The dates of the text, like the authorship of Paulines, post-Paulines, the synagogue expulsion theory around John, Markan priority, the demographics of audience. Was this book written for primarily Jewish or primarily non-Jewish audience? It's all, in a way, it's all guesswork, and it's normal for New Testament scholars to settle for the hypotheses with which they're comfortable. And to me, at this point, Q is a text when the Hermeneia series publishes a critical edition, when every intro to New Testament class in college, they've got to learn about the Q hypothesis. That's enough for me. So one more thing. I mean, between you and me, I say that, but actually it's between you and me and all these listeners. Sarah Rollins, another colleague who works in Q, has recently demonstrated that Q scholarship is very male-dominated. And the small percentage of women who work in Q, they work on women in Q for the most part. And she speculated at the latest SBL about some of the reasons for that. And part of it is kind of the combative nature of synoptics scholarship. Like, I have no interest in sparring in public over the hypotheses I use. I do have an interest in gender in early Judaism. And those who keep asking me, like, oh, what about the fair hypothesis? In my opinion, they risk sidelining women's scholarship and scholarship on gender and on gender with the historical Jesus, which is a lot of what's actually happening right now in Q.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I definitely want to make sure we touch on that subject as well. The question of who's working on these things and what happens and what's missed when not just, you know, women are not involved in asking certain questions, but when men are not asking about women in sources, and when all these other things, you know, and not listening to their female colleagues, and or not hiring their their academic peers as female colleagues, and all these things. But yeah, I was glad that you I had actually, when I was taking notes from your book, had jotted down. So what about people? You know, what about the Q skeptics and things like that? And then it's around page 152, 153, 154, somewhere in there, that part. When you address it directly, I was like, good. I'm so glad you did that. I remember when I was working on what became my first book, John's Apologetic Christology, but working on it as a doctoral dissertation, was still in two minds, and I'm still very much in two minds about whether John knew Mark, what sources written earlier did the author of the Gospel of John know in written form, and decided not to hitch my view of the development of John's Christology to direct dependence, and so emphasized,
smart,
knows these ideas or something like this tradition or something like that, and oftentimes it still works, right? So one of the messages is, of course, don't fail to read books that mention Q in the title just because you don't think Q is there.
Yes. But, at the end of the day, it's studying Jesus' sayings, which is always useful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we move on to another question, major question that I have, I do want to ask, you mentioned about the hypotheses that we build on, and, you know, dating and interdependence and things like that. And there was this one footnote that just caught my eye because I had this longstanding interest in it myself, about, you know, the dating of gospels and, you know, the independence or otherwise of the Gospel of John and things like that, that this work might lead one possibly to rethink. And I don't want you to sort of tip your hand about what may be a major future research project that you want to keep for yourself, but any clues or tantalizing tidbits about some of the thoughts that this project focused on Q brought to light in terms of possible broader implications for the study of the Gospels?
It's funny that you picked up on that one footnote. It was just like a side, like, oh, by the way, I'm thinking about this now. I always was taught John is independent, and I just accepted it. I didn't even look into it. But then a couple of years ago, I was doing this exercise with my undergraduates. We were doing Mary Magdalene, and I just got them to spread out all of the four resurrection accounts to chart kind of all the differences. And I just wanted them to see how important she was. Mm-hmm. She's the one constant. But what happened was I noticed that kind of race to the empty tomb situation in Luke and John. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, my cat is meowing. Where it seems
quite right.
Like one of those texts knows the other, because Luke and John both seem to agree we have to insert a man as a witness to the empty tomb. We've got all these ladies. We need a man to see this. But they don't agree which man it should be. Mm. And that's not my discovery. I found out later that that goes all the way back to Eusebius and various people over the centuries. Maybe most recently, 2016, I think, Chris Keith put this forward again. So my belief in John's independence was already shaky. But then I discovered that John and Luke also both have this kind of gender pairing at the narrative level. I mean, I knew about the paired parables, one's about a man, one's about a woman, but both John and Luke, which I did not realize, pair stories, like at the level of plot, with kind of a matching male protagonist, matching female protagonist. And that got me thinking, what about these two gospels are really in a conversation, or one is a response or a reactive to the other? So that was what that whole footnote was about.
Yeah, and I still wonder about the same thing. I sometimes wonder whether Luke might not be a response to John rather than vice versa.
Yes.
I think is an intriguing possibility, but any kind of evidence that seems to me decisive that would settle the matter for me still seems elusive to me.
Me too.
But
Yeah. My curiosity is piqued about that.
Yes. At the very least, they're having the traditions that are represented in these sources reflect conversations that are happening among early Christians, whether at the level of the text or before they get into the text or something. So you've mentioned a number of things that lead me to want to connect your work on this subject with something that I'm working on, a book which is going to be titled What Jesus Learned from Women.
What a great title.
Glad you like it. And I will have a defense of the use of the passive voice in there, but I'll save that for another time. But I know there's some people who care deeply about that sort of thing. But who do you think Jesus learned this from? Like the importance of including women as well as men in a way that was not typical of teachers in his time. Do you have any sense that, you know, did he grow up in a more egalitarian household? Did he have women in his life, mentors, teachers, something, you know, influences, conversation partners that we could at least speculatively identify that may have been influential sources of this facet of his teaching?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. I mean, I feel I'm going to know the answer when we read your book.
Oh, no.
But I wouldn't even try to answer that question, but I do want to take this opportunity to say this. One of the main points of my book is that uncovering a feminist Jesus can do serious harm when Jesus kind of gets pitted against Judaism. Mm-hmm. And held up as some kind of total anomaly. So I did want to highlight in my book that there were all kinds of ways that Jewish and non-Jewish women in the centuries before Jesus, like sort of the whole late Republic, were breaking out of expected roles in pockets here and there. We have, at that time period, we've got women philosophers. We have a Jewish queen, the Hasmonean queen. We have women becoming more publicly political and just more public in general. We have women as synagogue leaders in the diaspora. We have women initiating divorce, owning businesses, all that stuff. So while the overarching context was, of course, patriarchal or curiarchal, as Schuster Fiorenza would want us to call it, the fact that Jesus did have a couple of seriously egalitarian practices doesn't need to pull him out of his Jewish context. It still fits within it.
Yeah, well, just as a minor spoiler, I after reading your book, I'm going to include not just hopefully a quote or two and references to it, but one of the things I do in the book is try to not just talk about the women, but retell the stories sort of from their perspective and include that, a little sort of snippet of that. Oh. And I feel like I need to have, you know, a female acquaintance of Jesus who actually says to him, you know, I love your stories, but I don't really sort of find myself in them. And maybe, you know, Jesus thinks about that and sort of responds and includes women from then on in a new way or something. Because it seems like somebody must have had that. Yeah. It's the sort of thing that, I think Jesus would have perceived things that I do not perceive. And so I'm not trying to equate myself at his level in any way, shape, or form. But nonetheless, it does seem like the sort of thing that it's easiest to imagine a man becoming cognizant of in a patriarchal or curiarchal society when a woman that he's already open to listening to draws it to his attention. So, but it will be entirely speculative and arbitrary which of the possible conversation partners of Jesus that will be. And I have to acknowledge that a lot of times we can get a sense that Jesus was listening to women and taking seriously things that he had to learn from them. Yeah. But knowing which woman it was of, let's say, the various ones that are listed by Luke, right, as, you know, having been supporters of his ministry, was it Mary Magdalene? Was it Joanna? Was it,
Or what, some unnamed woman of which there may be, dozens and dozens that we'll never know of.
Yeah, so I will try to, but I'll attribute it to someone, but we'll acknowledge that the choice is somewhat arbitrary for the purpose of the book.
Well, you could put a footnote to Bernadette Bruton, who, I'm sorry, I don't know which article, but she wrote a lot about method, method of a feminist historian. And she said, we basically have to tear down everything that all the methods we use for the history of men by men. We need totally different methods and assumptions and canons and date ranges and modes for uncovering the history of women, because it's so hard. It's almost like we're trying to uncover like prehistoric stuff because there's so little evidence. It's all mediated through men. And then she says, one of the things you have to do to do women's history is you have to use your imagination. Mm. You have to be creative and speculate and reconstruct. So you're doing it right.
Yeah, well, that's something I discovered, you know, and I was glad, you know, I came across Bruton's work, and it sort of seemed to authorize the legitimacy of what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. That in essence, we can either allow women to continue to be silenced because it's like, well, we'd have to speculate, and we don't, as historians, we don't speculate, therefore we don't, you know, that's not a legitimate way of proceeding. But one of the things I discovered as I started being willing to transgress a boundary we sometimes try to make between history and what we might call historical fiction, where we're going beyond what the evidence strictly says and being willing to fill in the gaps, is that I think that's necessary. And I think it's also actually a surprisingly rigorous way of testing historical hypotheses.
Oh.
And the reason I say that is that I've seen suggestions about things that may have happened in the past, whether in relation to the New Testament or elsewhere, where if you try and tell it as a story, if you try to actually give the people involved plausible conversation and dialogue, you quickly get a sense that something's not right here. I can't imagine people actually talking this way. I can't imagine this unfolding this way.
Yeah.
And I think that the effort to do that actually can provide a rigorous kind of testing to our historical reconstructions, as well as giving us the freedom to explore the stories, the contributions of people whose stories and contributions have not been included or included in detail within the source material we have.
Mm-hmm. History from below. If history is written by the winners, but you actually want to learn about somebody else besides the winners for once, you've got to be willing to reconstruct tentatively.
Yeah. So my book is not going to be pure, you know, pure kind of standard traditional historical Jesus scholarship. It's not going to be
German Protestant historical criticism.
It's, yeah. I don't know what I think of what it's turning out to be, but I look forward to having some future conversation about what you think of it once it's out there.
All right.
But one of the things, yeah, as you mentioned, the danger of kind of anti-Judaism creeping in is people, you know, staying in a long line that goes back of tradition, going back to the Gospels themselves, wanting to emphasize Jesus and how great he is, have denigrated Judaism in the process. Yeah. And that's clearly one of the ways that work on this as a highlighting of what was distinctive about Jesus and his teaching, but also relating it to its context, that it's distinctive and yet not entirely unprecedented, allows for that material to speak to the problem of anti-Judaism in Christian supersessionism, in Christian theology, more generally, things like that. What are some of the ways that you think your work can actually, should actually be sort of read and dove into looking for application, not just for the study of Q or historical Jesus and New Testament scholarship, but for the church, for contemporary thought about some of these topics?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I did used to think more along the lines of, like you said, the kind of rigorous, historical, critical, kind of defensive, very cautious, afraid to say almost anything. That was kind of my mode. And this book was my PhD dissertation, and that's how it was written. I almost was afraid to claim anything. It was all tentative. And then near the end, when I was about to submit, people started asking me, oh, what's it about? And a lot of people, not academics, but people from the church, said things like, oh, wow, I can't wait to read that. This sounds so important. I really want to learn about Jesus and women. And I thought, oh, no, you don't want to read this. This is so boring. And before I made the dissertation into a book, I totally rewrote it, thinking about those people who like almost started crying, like, oh, yes, we need this. I really thought about them and tried to make it more relevant. And one of the ways, like you said, was we've got to deal with anti-Judaism in Christianity. A lot of it is by accident, but some of it is not, and it's very important. And the other thing is women. We're still in these struggles of, like, can we listen? Can a woman teach? Can we listen to a woman? And so many women and men believe that, no, we absolutely can't. But honestly, anyone in church, denominations and churches that has an opinion on gender, they can find a couple of Bible verses that agree with them. You can always go to the pastoral epistles and the household codes and say, well, there we go. The Bible says women are inferior and God wants them to be subservient. And then a different person can head to like Romans and see this movement that Paul inherited that was already filled with women prophets, deacons, apostles, and say, well, there we go. The Bible has women leaders, so it's egalitarian. But the truth is, it's complicated. It's ambiguous. It's in arguments with itself. So basically, I would hope that people don't need to lean on the Bible for an excuse to be decent human beings who show kindness and compassion. But for those who do, I do think maybe my book gives them some ammunition by saying, yes, Jesus of Nazareth was surrounded by women whom he deliberately catered to with his rhetoric and who he seemed to see as intellectual and spiritual equals. And he called both men and women to spread his movement and to sort of live out his Basileia ethics.
Wow. Well, although I was tempted to see if I could sidetrack us onto, you know, some of our shared pop culture interests, I actually want to keep the focus here and just really actually draw this conversation to a close and highlight, you know, some of what you just said, as well as the really, from my own perspective, inspirational things that you say in the conclusion to your book. And then maybe we'll have another conversation another time about, we can talk about Harry Potter and some more about Star Trek and
talk
about some of those other things, because we have enough shared interests that we should be having more than one conversation on the podcast.
I'm wearing my Deathly Hallows necklace right now.
Okay. Well, tempting to go there, but I just want to make sure we get that, you know, some of what you said there, that because you put it so nicely that, you know, there's, you know, there are women in the life of Jesus that he treated as equals. There are women that he listened to. There are women that, you know, he thought of as he thought about not just what he was going to teach, but how he's going to teach it, and whose stories and whose experiences are going to be reflected in the teaching so that it can be relevant and applied. And I think you really just put it so nicely towards the end of your book, saying that, you know, there's so much that we miss when, you know, women are not part of the study of these texts, but then also when women who study these texts are not listened to by, you know, men who are working on these texts, when questions about women and their experiences in their lives are not on the radar of scholars, sometimes even female scholars who are working in a male-dominated, you know, academic context or things like that. And so it's something I found to be true, you know, in working on the book I'm currently working on, and, you know, see how practically it shows itself in what you've written here, that actually asking these questions, just the very act of asking, where are women's stories? What does that tell us? When they're included, when we listen to that, when we imagine Jesus listening to them and their stories, what comes to light? And some of what does, I've been blown away by. And so Yeah, thank you so much for, you know, being on the podcast today. But thank you above all for working on this and for writing this book and for doing not just a detailed study that highlights something distinctive about the teaching of Jesus, the relevance of Q and the study of Q with these questions in mind, but also for that invitation that you put forth to the broader academic community to ask about these things, to focus attention here, and to do it in deliberate ways that really don't just, you know, bring new things to light, but open up whole new avenues of research and possibilities.
Oh, well, thanks for your invitation. I've had a great time. It's been wonderful.
Yes. Well, let me wrap things up by saying one more time that people who are listening should go and read Sarah Park's book, Gender in the Rhetoric of Jesus, Women in Q. For those who may have had the question at the start, okay, it has Q in the title. It's one of those academic books. It started out as a dissertation, but was rewritten with a broader audience in mind. It's still rigorous and scholarly all throughout. It goes into all kinds of detail. It is that sort of book. But I certainly would say from reading it that it's also one that is accessible and that a broader audience definitely should dive into it, should take a look at.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. So go out and get it and look forward to some future conversations between me and Sarah Parks talking about some of the other things that we're mm-hmm. interested in. Mm-hmm. So to everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us today, and bye for now.